Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
When we saw them last, Noah, his three sons, and four women were all on an ark waiting to finally settle. Right as we finished last week, we saw that the date that they hit the top of Mount Ararat coincides with the day of Jesus' resurrection, and that's where we finished last week. Now, if you think about eight people in an ark populating the earth, then you have to conclude that every people group that make up the human race on planet Earth are represented somewhere in those eight people. Logic just tells you that. You can think of the large people groups on planet Earth, whether that's the Mongol people, whether that's the Black African people, whether that's Red Indian people, whether that's the Middle Eastern dark-skinned people, whether that's the white European people. The large people groups of the Earth all stem from, flow from, and are represented in the gene pool of these eight people on the ark. And so what we're going to see in chapter 10 when we get to it is the beginning of the lineage, the breakdown of the different sons of Noah and the families of the earth that branch out from those different sons. And it's quite remarkable. You can read through chapter 10 and just go, well, that's just a lot of names. And tonight Jim is going to attempt to pronounce several of those names. Last year, one of the projects that I worked on, actually, it was the same project twice for two different publishers, is that we recorded the entire Old Testament, King James Version. And the fellow that we used to do the reading just went blowing through some of these Old Testament names and places and just hitting every one of them and rolling his R's and pronouncing every syllable and giving it a very Hebraic sound as he read it and getting plenty of phlegm behind his CHs and just really giving it this great reading. And I asked him at one point, I said, are you using a Hebrew dictionary for your pronunciations? Where are you getting these? Because they just sound so accurate. And he said, oh, no, no, no. I'm just making this up with great authority behind it, daring the publisher to tell me I'm wrong. And so that's the way we did the recording. Yeah, we just, yes, he just pronounced those names and we just went with them. And the amusing part is that we never heard back from either publisher. They never said, oh, could you repronounce that word? They just figured we knew. Because the fact of the matter is, especially some of these really ancient Hebrew names, the ancient Hebrew language didn't even have vowels. They had little vowel indicators. But much of the Hebrew language was more a spoken language than a written language to begin with. And so there really is no authoritative, definitive way to pronounce some of these old names, but I will do my best not to butcher them too badly as we get through them. But you can see chapter 10 coming and just go, oh, that's just the breakdown of a lot of different family lineages and it doesn't really matter. But it's really important. It really matters because it is the breakdown and distribution of the major people groups on planet Earth. And you're going to see God right away start dividing, start choosing, start electing, start cursing, and start designating people groups and where they're going to be on the planet. Which ties in very interestingly and very neatly with what we looked at the end of Sunday morning, and we're going to pick up again this Sunday, when Paul goes into Asia and is forbidden to preach. God has always taken responsibility for people groups and where they are and how much they know, and whether they remain in darkness, or whether he enlightens them, or what people groups he's going to use to spread the gospel, and even what individuals he's going to use to spread his gospel. And that's the only God you find in the Bible, is that absolutely sovereign one who determines what he's going to tell people and who he's going to tell it to. And there's really nothing you can do about that. It doesn't matter if you don't like it. There are plenty of folks who don't like that idea. In fact, Megan got into a conversation at RTA on Monday with a guy in her study hall. And she said, it's Sunday right now, my dad's teaching about how Paul went into certain areas and the Holy Spirit wouldn't let him preach to certain people. And he became upset by that idea and said, well, that's not in there. That's not in the Bible. And she said, well, yeah, it is. It's in Acts. I can show it to you. It's in there. And he said, it's not in there. But if it is, what it means is those people didn't want to know it. And they had a chance to hear it, but they just refused to hear it. And that's why God didn't say anything more to them, because they just didn't want to hear it anymore. So Megan and I were in the car laughing about the idea, because this is so typical of how so many people treat the Bible. If you follow his line of logic, it was, it's not in there. So he was sure it's not in there. And his second defense was, but if it is in there, it means this, which is really preposterous. The argument is, okay, you don't think it's in there, you know it's not in there, but if it is in there, you still know what it means. Wow, that's impressive. But that's the way most people treat the Bible. It's not in there. Then you show what it is in there. Hey, it's right there, black and white. Says it right here in Scripture. And they'll go, well, it doesn't mean that. The words on the page can't possibly mean that. Well, chapter 10 is an extended demonstration of the fact that God means what he says, because he's about to hand out a curse. And then through the rest of the Old Testament, you're going to see particular people groups, and you're going to see God bless one people group and curse another people group and use the blessed lineage as the hammer against the cursed group. And then you're going to see God occasionally use the cursed group as the battle axe, the hammer, against the blessed people. And this is all God doing exactly what he said from the beginning he would do. Pick, choose, divide, determine. It's all up to him. So let's pick up where we left off last week, which is Genesis 9. No, we're going to have to start before that. So let's start in chapter 8, verse 4. No, let's just start at chapter 8, verse 1. Okay, Genesis 1, 1.
That's where Shane's
in. I know. God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that were with him on the ark, and God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters were assuaged. And the fountains also of the deep and the windows of the heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested on the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountain of Ararat. Why did Moses take the time to say that it rested on Mount Ararat? The reason is that gives us a geographic location in the world. That's the Middle Eastern territory where mankind is going to begin establishing itself. In fact, right away, you're going to see that the descendants of Ham, Nimrod, is going to establish Babel, which is going to become Babylon. Well, all of the cities that grow up in that area, all Middle Eastern names. You're going to recognize names tonight. And you're going to recognize that they're all Middle Eastern names. That's why it's important that Moses would say he landed on Ararat. That starts all of humanity then, from Noah forward, as being right there in that Black Sea, Middle Eastern area. The waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent forth a raven, which went forth to and fro until the waters were dried up from off the earth. And he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters were abated from off the face of the ground. But the dove found no rest for the sole of her foot, and she returned unto him into the ark, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Then he put forth his hand, and he took her, and he pulled her into the ark. So he sent out two birds to find out if there was any dry land out there. First bird he sends out was a raven. There's no indication that the raven returns, because ravens live on dead things. They're a carrion bird. And so they'd be able to survive on the dead things floating on the water and all the other mess on the mountaintops. They'd be able to live on that. The dove would not. The dove is going to be looking for something fresh it could eat, or some kind of fruit or some berries off a tree. And so the dove comes back. That lets Noah know that there's nothing out there to eat and nothing living yet. Verse 10, and he stayed yet another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came in to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. That sign, that emblem, by the way, to this very day, is a symbol of peace and a symbol of new beginnings. Anytime you see a dove with an olive branch in its mouth, an international sign of peace, well, that's where you get it. The dove that returned, letting Noah know that There was now life on earth. Trees were growing somewhere, and he had managed to pluck off a leaf. And so the dove came in to him in the evening. Verse 12, he stayed yet another week after that, another 7 days, and sent forth the dove, which did not return to him anymore. So he knew the dove had found sufficient to eat. And it came to pass in the 600th first year, in the first month, in the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark. And he looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, was the earth dried. And God spoke unto Noah, saying, Go forth out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, and bring forth with you every living thing that is with you, of all flesh, both the fowl and of the cattle, of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, that they may breed abundantly in the earth and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. And Noah went forth, and his sons and his sons' wives with him, every beast, every creeping thing, and every fowl, and whatsoever creeps upon the earth, after their kinds. And they went forth out of the ark. And Noah, I find this fascinating, and Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast, the ones he took by sevens, and of every clean fowl, every clean bird, and he offered burnt offerings on the altar. How does Noah know to do this? And again, we're only 8 chapters into the book of Genesis. How many offerings have we seen now? We've seen continual offerings, constant offerings to God. Clearly, somewhere in their development, God let them know that he required this. Starting right off with Adam and Eve's sin, their recognition that they were naked, and then God killing an animal and using the skin to cover them. A sign of substitutionary atonement, something dying for their sin to cover their nakedness and their sin. But then the next thing you see is Cain and Abel. You've got 4 people now on the planet, Cain and Abel. The difference between them, the separation between them, has to do with their offerings. They bring offerings to God. You see offerings continually through the Old Testament. And as I've said, I think each week that I've brought this up, it doesn't change. It's the same God. The same God in heaven still expects that you are going to recognize and sacrifice to that God who has, after all, given you everything. And as much bad and errant teaching as there is in the church world on giving, for years and years and years, I erred on the opposite side of it because Tom and I come out of a church in L.A. that said, you know, if you're not tithing at least 30% of everything you make and giving the first check of every year, your first paycheck was a first fruit offering you had to give. And if you didn't do any of this stuff, God was going to curse you and smite you. And if you wanted God to care for you, in fact, he said, if you don't trust God with your wallet, you don't trust God at all. And if you're not tithing, you're going to go to hell. I mean, this is the kind of teaching Tom and I grew up under, this very staunch, strong, legalistic giving message. And so when I started teaching the Bible, you know, one of the early books that I wrote was A Guide to New Covenant Giving, which I really wrote in response to all of the errant stuff that Tom and I had been taught, and to try to clear up all the misnomers about giving. And so while it's true that systematic tithing, legalistic tithing, all of that kind of stuff is not a part of the New Covenant, nevertheless, giving and generous giving and sacrificial giving is. And the assumption all the way through the New Testament is that you will give. You'll give generously. You'll give from your heart. You'll give according as you determine. And there's no more standards where you got to give 10 or 20 or 30%. And if you don't give all these offerings, and then your free will offerings and your first fruit offering and your wave offering and your sheave offering and your drink offering, all that's done away with. But there is nowhere in the New Testament where you read that God has now said, and by the way, I really don't expect anything else from you. Paul's teaching is, in Romans 12, that in fact God expects everything from you. Everything you are, everything you have, everything you know, the whole and complete person. He says now we are to bring ourselves to God in this new living fashion, instead of dead sacrifice, that we are now to bring ourselves to God a living sacrifice, which he then says is your reasonable service. And I think I told you last week it's the word from which we get logic. It's your logical service that you would give to God. And my point is, no sooner does God have creatures, cognizant creatures, creatures he communicates with on the planet, than they know to sacrifice. And God prepares for the sacrifice by making sure that there are sufficient clean animals on the ark before the flood even comes to guarantee that after the flood, they would have something to give him back. You understand that? And so look around in your life, because I hear people sometimes argue, well, I can't give because my financial situation is such that I can't give. I can't give anything. But the reality is, everything you have is what God gave you, and if he has given you anything at all, he has given you sufficient to give something. And I don't just mean putting money in the box over there. I've been very, very proud of this church body this week as I've seen everybody rise to the occasion to help Renee. And she called me yesterday. I went by and saw her today. And she's really genuinely overwhelmed and surprised that people she barely knows are reaching out to her to the extent that we are. But that's giving. That's sacrifice. That's kindness. That's okay, I've got food and my sister needs food. Well, here, then you'll have food. Whatever you've got, anybody else in the body that needs, if you've got it, God gave it to you so that you could give it to that person who needs it. Never does God give it to you to hoard it to yourself. You'll notice that Noah did not get off the boat and go, okay, well, there's two of every animal, but hey, there's seven of these kind of animals, therefore these are mine. Instead, he took the excess animals and burned them to God's glory, seeing God as the provider in all things and of everything. And he recognized that the only things he had of any value at this point were these animals. This is his food. This is his sustenance. That's all he has. He doesn't have any home or car or computer, or he's got nothing. So Noah gets off the boat, and the only thing he's got of any value are these animals, the clean animals that can be eaten, the only ones that there's multiples of, so if you do eat them, you don't destroy the whole breed. That's all he's got. And he sacrifices it to God. Where did he get that mindset? Where did that idea come from? That the best of what he had was to be burned. Well, that idea is brought all the way into the New Testament. Not only is burning animals all the way through the law and through the Old Testament, but Paul picks it up in the New Testament and says that when you give sacrificially, hilariously, God loves joyful giving. And Paul says that when you give joyfully, generously, sacrificially, he says it sends a sweet savor up into God's nostrils. And he picked that particular kind of Old Testament offering, the sweet savor offering, where you would take the best of what you had and you would burn it for God's glory. And that would bring this sweet scent into God's nostrils. Well, this is exactly what Noah's doing back here, 8 chapters into the book. Where did he learn to do this? And why did God immediately, as soon as he made creatures and as soon as they fell, start asking for sacrifice? And has God changed? Those are all the questions you got to ask. So if you've got anything, you have something you can give. Right?
Yep.
Okay. I've seen folks sometimes say to me, well, I can't give anything. I'd like to give. I'd like to give. And when I make more money, I will give. And I always say, no, you won't. No, you won't, because you have no idea how rich you are right now. You drive in a car, you got clothes on your back and a closet full of clothes, you got plenty of food to eat. If you're driving down the road and you go, hey, I'm a little bit hungry, you can pull into a drive-thru and 5 minutes later you'll be cramming food into your mouth. You are so rich. If you live in the bottom percentile in America right now, you're still richer than 90% of the rest of the world that live in an absolutely impoverished state. And yet we have this great capacity to, kind of like water finding its own level, we have this great capacity to take whatever God has given us and start deciding that it's not enough, it's not sufficient. If I just had more, then I'd be happy, or then I could give, all that stuff. The truth of the matter is, God has promised you food and raiment, something to eat today, something to wear today. Everything you have beyond that is actually excess. And just by his grace, he has given you more than one change of clothes and today's food. You have no guarantee you're going to be here tomorrow. So if he's fed you today and you had clothes on your back, then he's kept his promise to you. And everything else you have, okay, let's make a list of the everything else now. Whatever you have on right now and the food you ate today, now think about everything else you have. Everything else you have is excess, above and beyond what he promised you, which is just food and raiment for today. Do you get that? What did Jesus mean when he walked around saying things like, take no thought for the morrow. The things of tomorrow will care for themselves. Sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof. You just worry about today. And then, of course, he looked at the birds in the sky and said, behold the sparrows, two of them are sold for a farthing, and not a one of them can fall from heaven without your Father. Now, if he so cares about birds, doesn't he care about you? That was Jesus' argument. Well, then the answer is yes, absolutely. He cares for me. He cares for me enough to provide for me every day what he's promised to provide. And what he's promised is food and raiment. So then there's nobody in this room that doesn't have excess. So don't tell me you can't give. Right? All right. So right away he sacrifices. Right away burnt offerings occur. Verse 20. Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and he took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and he offered burnt offerings on the altar. And look at verse 21. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. There's God's view of human beings. Man's heart is evil from his youth. By the way, you'll notice there's nothing said there about an age of accountability. Very popular notion among folk who want to say that you have to make a decision in order to be saved. They'll say, well, if children die before a certain age, then they're not accountable for whatever sinfulness they might have, and therefore God accepts them into heaven automatically. But here's God's view of it. Man is sinful from his youth. There's so many of these verses that say that human beings, from inception, from birth, are sinful. And if there's any point at which human beings are not sinful, if you think it through logically, then you're saying that there is a duration of life where you don't really need a savior. There's some part of your life where you're actually innocent enough on your own that God is going to accept you on the basis of your own goodness, or at very least, your lack of badness.
By curse the ground there, does he mean a flood in particular, or?
Hang on. Okay, because he's going to say what he means.
Okay.
So God sees human beings as evil from their youth. He says, I will no longer, or I will not again, curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore every living thing as I have done. That's what it means. He's saying, I will no longer cover the whole ground with water so that I destroy the whole earth and everything that's living on it. That's cursing the whole ground. And I'm not going to smite everything that lives and kill everything all at once again. Because man is evil, he says in the middle of it. So man does deserve that. But I, of my grace, I'm now making a covenant with you that I'm not going to do that anymore. But of course, you read about it in 1 Peter, that God is going to destroy the earth and all the elements and everything with a fervent heat. He's going to burn it up with fire, but the promise he's making here is that he won't again flood the earth, and he's going to add a token of that covenant. Now, is the earth still cursed to the degree that mankind is still sinful and that there's still going to be thorns and thistles and we still have to work from the sweat of our brow? Yeah, because that's part of the Adamic curse. But this particular curse of the ground was when it repented him that he had made mankind because of their continual evil. So he's saying here, even though mankind is evil, I'm no longer going to flood the earth. I'm not going to do that one again.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, sir.
In MacArthur's study Bible, I think he makes an interesting comment about verse 22, where God speaks about these different seasons and cycles and so forth. He says, with many alterations from the global flood, God reestablished the cycle of seasons after the catastrophic interruption. And that's an interesting thought, because if you think about them being in the ark for a year, it seems like an awful lot was interrupted during that year. There probably wasn't traditional standard cyclical seasons like we know.
Well, I would go further back than that, actually, Rick. If what we understand from the early parts of Genesis about there being a covering or a canopy over the earth and a mist that came up from the earth that watered the whole ground, then you wouldn't have really what we consider seasons in the same typical way, where the northern and southern hemisphere, you know, opposite heat and cold, because you'd have the canopy over the whole earth. So the introduction of seasons, and even the introduction of the rays of the sun being able to hit human beings, the next thing we're going to see is that age drops dramatically. God said before the curse of the flood, he said 120 years is going to be the life of a man. People have been living 800, 900 years. The next few people he's going to name, suddenly the lifespans are dropping to 300 to 400 years. And I think there's a whole lot happening cataclysmically here. It's not just seasons. Everything of what was the original order has been completely disrupted. And so I think that comment, which we hadn't quite gotten to verse 22 yet, but when he says, while the earth remains, which in and of itself has intrinsic in it, that it won't always be here, that it was not created with the intention that it was going to be eternal. He's saying there's a time frame to the earth. And as long as the earth remains, certain things are going to be true, like seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease as long as the earth remains. So I really have always understood that statement to be now that the flood has happened, now that the canopy has burst, now that men are going to be much more affected directly by the sun, now that lifespan is going to be shortened, now seasons have come into play. And God is speaking directly to that and saying, now as long as the earth remains, as part of this promise that I'm no longer going to flood the earth, as part of that promise, as long as the earth remains, there's going to be seasons and days and nights, and I promise you it'll remain like that for as long as the earth remains. So while the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease, I believe is all part of this same promise.
So he's really, from the perspective you're explaining there, describing kind of a new cycle.
Yes, I think it's a new cycle.
A series of events, yes, that are going to not cease while,
right,
the earth remains,
right,
as it does now.
All as part of this promise that I'm no longer going to destroy mankind even though they're evil, and as long as the earth exists, I as God will faithfully see to it that all of this new structure exists, and as long as it exists, you see me at work. I think we just naturally take for granted absolutely everything God does. And what God is announcing here is, for as long as the world exists and you see these things, I'm still actively at work. But unless we see people raised from the dead, or somebody growing a new leg, or, you know, something truly, genuinely, outrageously miraculous, we're likely to think that God is dormant, when in fact God is so into the minutiae of everything that happens in his universe, we become familiar with God. And our familiarity does genuinely breed contempt, where we reach the point of just thinking God's always acted that way, so he's always going to act that way. And I think that's a dangerous way to think.
Well, maybe tied to that, though, as far as the shortening of man's lifespan, it probably served to limit and curtail the evil that he could perpetrate during his lifetime.
Possibly.
You have only 70 to 100 years to be evil, but it's to limit, you know, versus 800 to 900 years of being evil.
I don't know. I don't even know how to make those kind of judgments, because as far as I'm concerned, one sin against an infinitely holy God is an infinite sin worthy of infinite punishment. So if you multiply that by 70 years or 900 years, I don't know that that actually increases the affront to an infinitely holy God. But
not on that side of the equation, but as far as the devastation to the world and to other...
We can do less damage to the planet.
Exactly right.
Interesting. Chapter 9. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to him, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth. Isn't that interesting? That all the other beasts of the earth were suitable for hunting by human beings. And upon every fowl of the air and upon everything that moves on the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea, into your hands they are delivered. And so God understood from the beginning that all animals, fish, birds, everything could be used, hunted, eaten by man, and he gave mankind that priority. Despite all of the liberal movements that have grown up in the last 30 years, especially in the world, where now in areas of Europe they're trying to give dogs civil rights. And and you're not allowed to use the language of owner, it's your partner, you know, and this kind of stuff. So that kind of excessive notion that animals are equal with humans and therefore have equal rights as humans can't be borne out in the Bible. Right away, God says to Noah and his eight, you're the ones who have to be sustained, and all of these animals can be used by you for your sustenance. And that phrase, into your hands they have been delivered, is awfully telling of God's attitude. Every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. So they could eat of the fruit, the green herbs, they could eat of the animals. You'll notice there were no dietary restrictions here. You'll notice no kosher rules. All of that comes along later as part of the law. Rules about not eating anything with a split hoof, clean and unclean animals, all of that comes up later. But notice here there is one element, and oddly enough, Pam, this is going to play into a question you asked me Sunday after church. We noticed Sunday that those couple of rules that were given to the Gentiles by the leaders of Jerusalem included not eating meat sacrificed to foreign gods, and it included no fornication. And then it said, and don't eat anything strangled or with the blood. And Pam asked me afterwards, well, what's the importance of that? Why not in the blood? Of course, her question was, can I no longer have a rare steak? That was her chief concern. And I said, no, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about not cooking something that the blood has not been drained out of. The kosher way to kill an animal, hang it by its feet, cut its neck, let the blood run out, and then cook it. Well, that rule, it comes into play all the way back here in Genesis. And what I told Pam was, God makes it very clear very early on that the life of a creature is in its blood. And therefore, you had to drain its blood out so it was genuinely, totally dead, actual dead, before you would cook and eat the thing. And so, verse 4, but the flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. So that dietary restriction came into place right after Noah, and when the leaders of Jerusalem were talking to the Gentiles, they carried on that restriction. Apparently, this is a restriction that's universal in God's scope, that if you're going to eat an animal, you have to make sure that you don't eat the blood of it, because the life of the thing is in the blood.
Against cannibalism? Is that what that is?
No. Well, I think it innately is against cannibalism, because it's every animal and every fruit of the field. It does not say, and you can eat other human beings. Cannibalism is always against God's will. Yeah, sure. And in fact, by the way, since you brought up cannibalism, he's going to point out that any animal or any man that kills a man is responsible in a different way than men are responsible for killing an animal. Men have superiority over animals. They're all delivered into men's hands, and you can kill an animal. But now he's going to lay down rules about killing a man, and say the difference is man is the only creature that was created in God's image. So the rules are different. So certainly that would also apply to cannibalism. Yeah. But thanks for bringing it up, just so that the whole room could collectively go, ooh. Yeah. So you just... Verse 5. And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast also will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of a man. So whether an animal kills a man, whether a man kills a man, God says, I will require the blood of anyone or any creature that kills a man. So completely different rule there. Verse 6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Very famous verse that is used in just about every capital punishment court case out there, that it has always been God's view that a man who sheds blood, his blood will also be shed. And you find that in the law as well. For in the image of God made he man, and that's what makes man distinct from animals. Now, nothing about this is contrary to what we really emphasized in the last couple weeks, that man was then in Adam's image and all born into sin. That's obvious by what we just read, God saying that the imaginations of man from their youth is sinful always. So men are still sinful, they're depraved, but they're the only creature that was made in God's image by God. And therefore, the life of a human being is different than the life of an animal in God's eyes, because human beings have eternal life, have souls, and have what no other creature has, which is direct communication with God. There is no revelation from God being given to kangaroos. Mankind are the only ones that are getting a direct revelation from God. So that makes us unique and different. And also the top of the food chain. Go man. Yes?
Is this implying in any way a judgment for animals when it talks about a reckoning?
I don't think that it's a judgment, because since animals were not made in God's image, then they have no capacity for right and wrong. They have no capacity to sin. They have no ability to do anything that God would judge them for. I think rather they were put on the planet just like trees, just like oxygen, just like everything else. They were made for the support of human beings. God, knowing he was going to make humans, put everything in place to support human life, and they're part of that support system. But there's nothing in any animal that God could say was intrinsically sinful.
And, you know, the emphasis here seems to be not so much on accountability of animals, or even on the accountability of men who kill men, but rather on the disrespect shown to God, that the image of God is mistreated in the killing of a man.
Yeah. And that also God has every right and power to distinguish between them and say, this creature can be used for food. This creature you can't touch. They're mine. I've chosen them. I've created them after my image. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Verse 7, and you, be ye fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. And God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and I, behold, I establish my covenant with you. Real covenant language going on here. And in every covenant that you find in the Bible, there is a token associated with the covenant, some sign, some insignia that the covenant is in effect. And so he adds that, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed or your descendants after you. And this particular covenant, look at the universality of the scope of this covenant. Verse 10, I establish this covenant with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl and of the cattle and of every beast on the earth with you, from all of you that go out of the ark and to every beast on the earth. This is a covenant God makes with every living creature. Every animal, every bird, every snake, every fish, and every human is under this particular covenant. What a universal covenant this is. Now later we're going to see covenants like the Abrahamic covenant that are very limited in scope, where God says, this covenant is with you and your seed. And then we're going to see the covenant made at Mount Sinai, made specifically with Israel, a specific covenant. We're going to see a covenant made with David and his family, a specific covenant. But this covenant that has to do with, I will never again destroy the earth with water and kill everything on the earth, God makes that covenant with every creature because it is a universal covenant of, I will keep you all alive. Which means every day that you see animals on the planet, that's another day that God is keeping his covenant with everybody. Got that? There was a hand. Karen.
Well, what's the significance of adding every living creature, you know, in that? I mean, if you had just said people and you said, and everything, it would have been kind of distinctive, but to say every living creature that's with you, birds and cattle, and to get really specific.
Well, let me be clear. God does have, while it's not a salvific relationship necessarily, God does have a very distinct relationship with every creature he makes. Mm-hmm. You read it all the way through the Bible, things like, even Jesus saying, foxes have dens, you know, and the Son of God has nowhere to lay his head. He talks about, you know, the birds of the air, the cattle on a thousand hills are the Lord's. Animals are used throughout Scripture as having a relationship, that the birds cry out to God and that God feeds baby lions. You read all about that in Job. So there's no question that God has an actual relationship with every living creature in his domain and in his creation. It's not like he made animals and then backed away from them. He made them and sustains them and takes credit for sustaining them and says that they know their God and they cry out to their God. But they are not living creatures that have souls, that are spoken of being saved, of being sinful, of needing a redeemer. All of that is unique to mankind. But the fact that God has a saving relationship with mankind doesn't mean that he has no relationship with the rest of his creation. Everything he creates, he has an intimate relationship with. They belong to him, and he sustains them. He gives them life. And so I can see why God could make a promise with every living thing that, okay, now I made a bunch of living things and then I killed you all, so now I'm going to make a promise to you all that I won't do that anymore. God has this very, very personal relationship with the entirety of his creation in a way that I don't think we can begin to imagine.
It says that the whole creation is under a curse as well. The whole creation groans and travails.
Yep. Every living creature that is with you, of the fowl and the cattle and the beast of the field that's with you, all of you that are in the ark and every beast on the earth, and I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh, see all flesh there, that means animals, humans, birds, all flesh. Neither shall all flesh be cut off anymore by the waters of a flood. Neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow, my rainbow, in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of the covenant between me and the earth. Now, this kind of plays into what you and I were talking about a few minutes ago, Rick, which is that rainbows would not have existed prior to there being the destruction of the canopy. That with the destruction of the canopy and there now being clouds in the air, which would gather water and it would rain, because there had never been rain before the flood, now that you have clouds, you have the refraction of water in the sky creating rainbows. So God is saying, now that there's been this whole cataclysmic change to the way the whole world works, one of the benefits of that is there's going to be these spectrums of light in the sky, these bows that I put up there, and I'm going to recognize those as being a token of this covenant. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth, and it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it. I love the intimacy of that language. Because I love rainbows. I'm just one of those kind of guys who just gets stupid, you know. Rainbow, come here, kids! And they're like, yeah, Dad, you know. To me, that's just one more indication of God's up there doing his thing, doing his work. It's a cloudy day. Hey, there's a rainbow. No flood's coming today. He's not going to destroy the whole earth. There's his rainbow right there. And I think of it as being something he put there for us to look at and say, there's God's promise. But look at the language here. God says, I'll see it, and I'll remember my covenant when I see it. So God said he put it up there as a reminder to himself as well, that he's no longer going to destroy the earth. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth, and it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth, and the bow shall be seen in the cloud, I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh, and the bow shall be in the clouds, and I will look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. And the sons of Noah that went forth out of the ark are Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. So the first child mentioned, Noah's first grandchild, is Canaan. The reason it's important is because Canaan is the namesake of the Canaanites. And through the rest of the Old Testament, you're going to read about Canaanites. And the land that's going to be promised to Abraham is the land of Canaan. And you're going to see that the promise of giving the land to Abraham, who we're going to find out in a moment is a descendant of Shem, the blessed line, he's going to be given the land of Canaan because of a curse that is put on Canaan. And so all of the stuff that God's going to do for the next several chapters of the book of Genesis, including the Abrahamic covenant, is a direct result of the stuff you're about to read here. So that's why I'm emphasizing the importance of this. He had three sons, and of them was the whole world overspread. So all people groups, as I said at the beginning, came out of them. And Noah began to be a husbandman, which means he became a farmer, started planting. And he planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine. And he was drunk. And he was naked inside his tent. So he was real drunk. Drunk and naked, laying around his tent. I think that will dispel any rumors that Noah was such a phenomenally righteous man, that that's why God chose him. I also think, by the way, though, if you got to spend a year on a boat with that many animals, when it's all over and you're on dry ground, I can kind of see the drunken naked thing. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying I understand. That was a long year. But enough time has passed here where he had time to plant and things grew and he had time for the grapes to ferment. He had enough time and he knew what he was doing. He was clearly trying to make some wine. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and he told his other two brothers about it. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and they laid it both upon their shoulders and they went backwards and they covered the nakedness of their father. So when their brother came and said, "Dad's drunk and naked in his tent," and it obviously looked at him, the other two brothers, rather than risk looking at him, stood side by side, picked up a garment, put it over their shoulders, walked backwards and dropped it over Dad, which is the kind way to cover Dad up. Now I also have to point out, there are two different words in the Hebrew for naked. One of them is like talking about Adam and Eve, and they were naked and there was no shame. But the word that's being used here for uncovered nakedness is a word that has shame in it. And so it is a shameful nakedness that's going on here. And that has caused no end of controversy as to what was the shame. But Noah is about to awaken and realize, even though he's covered, that something shameful has taken place. So let's read on. And Noah awoke from his wine, verse 24, and he knew what his youngest son had done unto him. Youngest son in that case is probably a reference to Canaan because that's who he's going to curse. So he's talking about his grandson. So if you put all the little pieces together here, what you've got is Ham seeing Dad naked in the tent in a shameful way in his drunkenness, going and telling his brothers covering him up, and then Noah cursing Canaan for whatever the shameful part of it was. Now, nobody knows what the shameful part was. It's led to all kinds of speculation as to what the shameful part of it was or what took place. But something happened in that tent that made his nakedness a shameful thing. So shameful that Noah is going to curse Canaan specifically for it, and that curse is going to continue through the rest of the Old Testament. So we're talking about a big shame. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Now, it was pointed out to me in an email this week that I've spoken about the curse of Ham, the last couple of weeks, and that actually the curse falls on Canaan, the son of Ham. So I should have been specific. So, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan will be his servant." The Shemites then, we hear a lot these days about anti-Semitism, Semites. Semite is an anglicized version of the word Shemite, a descendant of Shem. The Jewish races, the Israelite races, are going to come out of Shem, the blessed line. And the Canaanites are going to become the people who establish Babel and Nineveh and the Middle Eastern Arab nations who are under a curse where they're to be servant to the Shemites. And so the Shemites are going to be given the land of Canaan. First, God is going to give Canaan some land, and then it's going to be given by promise to the Shemites. So this curse is going to play out. This curse and this blessing is going to play out. And in fact, there is a period of time during the Judges when the Canaanites in that area actually are subject to the Shemites and actually do end up being water bearers and woodworkers for them and genuinely are servants of servants for the Shemites. So this curse is very real and it does play out in time. "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem." That's very interesting because the descendants of Japheth, which essentially means pale, those descendants are the Europeans. And so you've got Europeans and Shemites being blessed together in this blessing, and Japheth dwelling in the tents of the Shemites, which is a really interesting foreshadow of the fact that salvation comes through the Shemites, but the Gentiles are brought in. The Europeans, the Japhethites, are brought into that blessing of Christ. So God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And at this very moment in history, where we live right now, it is predominantly the Japheth white European nations that are over there fighting with the descendants of the Canaanites, and the whole thing revolves around what's going to be the eventual outcome of the Shemites. Do you realize that? It is the Canaanites that at this very moment are saying they're going to blow the Shemites off the earth, off the planet, push Israel into the sea, nuke them into the Stone Age. And who's defending them? Us, the Japhethites. We're right in there defending the Shemites against the Canaanites. So don't tell me these early chapters of Genesis are not relevant. People sit down in the evening news and they read about this stuff going on in the Middle East and they say, well, if we can just get the leaders of these two groups to meet on the White House lawn and sign a piece of paper and shake hands, then we can bring peace to the Middle East. No, you can't, because the upsets and the difficulties and the hatred goes all the way back here. These are old, ancient curses. And as we're going to see through the progress of these people groups in the Middle East, you're going to see right away that the animosity begins and continues because we're still talking about the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, demonstrated in Cain and Abel, and then it's demonstrated here. Here's God picking and choosing again. Here's God dividing again. Here's God cursing people and blessing people again. And here we've got evil cursed descendants, and here we've got blessed descendants, and God continues to do what God has always done, pick and choose and bless and curse. That's the God we deal with. And I think Tom had asked me a few weeks ago, well, what about the flood? Once the flood comes and goes, do you still have a seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent? And I said, yes, because the seed of the serpent is all sinful mankind, and a subset within all of mankind is the seed of the woman, that blessed seed, that blessed lineage that's leading to Christ. And guess which of these three sons that seed moves through? The Shemites. It is through Shem, the blessed line, that Christ comes. And of course, you can read in the early lineages and the genealogies in the beginning of the book of Luke. You can read all the way back through Shem, but that's the lineage of Jesus. Blessed shall be the God of Shem. Canaan shall be his servants. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. After 950 years, I'll bet he was happy to call it quits. What a life that guy led. Which finally takes us to chapter 10, which is where I said we were starting tonight. And we begin into the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem and Ham and Japheth. And unto them were born sons after the flood. And the sons of Japheth are Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tyrus. Who are those people groups? Where do you see those names?
In Revelation.
You see it in Revelation. You see it in Ezekiel. Those are the people groups that are said to be separate from the Shemites and yet be part of that whole battle in the Middle Eastern area. But they are always coming down from the north or from the west. You're still talking Europeans. And the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha and Tarshish, and Kittim, and Dodanim, why not? By these were the isles. Now look at those names. Pay attention here. Look at the next thing. Moses makes sure we understand who that people group is. Verse 5, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided into their lands. So who are we talking about? Talking about Gentiles. We're not talking about Canaanite Gentiles, non-Canaanite Gentiles who occupy the isles of the Gentiles.
I didn't even think the word Gentile really played into effect until...
Don't forget, this is Moses writing. Right. And so he's writing past tense. Okay, now here's these people groups, and let me tell you who they become.
Wow.
So these are the people groups, the descendants of Japheth, who become the non-Canaanite Gentiles. What he's trying to prove at this point, this is what I said at the beginning of the evening, what he's going to try to prove in chapter 10 is that all the people groups of the planet all find their heritage in those first eight people on the boat.
Okay.
And so he's drawing connections after the fact. Don't forget that this is during Moses' time that it's
right.
being written.
Right.
And he's writing and making connections after the fact to say those eight people on the boat, represent all the major people groups on the planet.
Okay.
So he's connecting dots for us.
And these people wouldn't have been too far anyhow because the Atara battle hasn't occurred anyhow. They wouldn't have traveled too far.
Right.
The Middle East.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. So he has named the sons of Japheth and has told us specifically by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands. Everyone after his tongue, after his families in their nations. Yes, now when he's talking about everyone out by their tongues, he's speaking about people groups who live before the Tower of Babel, but he's saying after the Tower of Babel, they went out and populated and they became these people. And the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. And the sons of Cush were Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Ramah and Sabtika. And that's my best shot. And the sons of Ramah were Sheba and Dodan. And Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, which is where we get the word Babylon to this very day. So now we know the area of the country we're talking about. Notice that it is the descendants of Ham through Cush that begat Nimrod, who built Babylon. So we know we're talking about the area of Iraq at that point. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calna in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher, and he built Nineveh, which is going to become the capital later of Assyria. And the city of Rehoboth and Caleb, and Rezin, the city between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And Mizraim begat Ludim, and Anamim, and Lehabim, and some other guys, and Naphtahim, and Pathrasim, and Caslahim, out of whom, look at this language, out of whom came Philistine, or Philistine, who's going to be the father of who? The Philistines, ancient enemies. Remember what he said, the curse is this group of descendants coming out of Ham, coming out of Canaan, this is going to be the group that's always going to be against the Shemites. And Caphtorim, and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite. Now, where do you hear those names later on?
When Israel's coming back up into the land of Canaan.
Israel's coming into the land of Canaan, and they meet up with all those people groups. So Moses is saying, now, okay, our ancient enemies, remember who he's writing to when he writes this in the first place. He's writing this to the Israelites. He's saying, okay, now all those enemies that we found when we came to the land of Canaan, the land God promised us, we found these people groups there. Why are we having such a big problem with these people groups? Well, for one, we're trying to take their land because God has promised us their land. And why are they so against us? Because they are the descendants of Canaan who is under a curse. And so, of course, since they are cursed to be our servants, not only would that build up the Israelites' mindset that we should go and conquer these people, God has cursed them to be our servants, but also it's an explanation to the people of Israel by Moses for why these people groups are there in the land of Canaan, in a land that's been promised to them, and why it's okay to go in and slaughter and conquer and kill them, because they've been cursed ever since back here. So Moses is just connecting dots like mad. And verse 17, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite, and afterward were all the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as you come to Gerar, unto Gaza. Any of that sound familiar? Gaza, where all the trouble is right now, between these same two ancient people groups. As you go unto Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. Obviously, these are city places that didn't exist when they were getting off the boat. So Noah is talking way after the fact and explaining how all these different people groups connect to the eight people on the boat. And these are the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, after their countries, and in their nations. Unto Shem also, the Shemites, the father of all the children of Eber. There are people who claim an etymological link between Eber and Eberu, the root of Hebrew. And so when he says that Shem was the father of the Eberus, or these are the children of Eber, there's some indication that that may be why the first time that we see the word Hebrew, it's a connection to a descendant of Shem, Abraham. Pardon me?
The people, I think maybe from the people, Habiru.
Right. Hebrew is one of those names that means a sojourner, a wanderer, somebody who doesn't have a home, but the etymology of the word is real vague. But if you look at it contextually, the closest word to it before it shows up in the text in chapter 12 is this guy Eber. And so unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, even unto him were children born, and the children of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. And the children of Aram were Uz. Verse 23, and the children were Aram and Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. And Arphaxad begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber. And unto Eber were born two sons, the name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And Joktan begat Almadad, and Sheleph, and Hazar Maveth, and Jerah, and Hadaram, and Uzal, and Dikla, and Obel, and Abimael, and Sheba, and Ophir, and Havilah, and Jobab, all these were the sons of Joktan, or Joktan. And their dwelling was from Mesha, as you go unto Shephar, a mountain in the east. And these are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations. And by these were all the nations divided in the earth after the flood. So that's the point of all of those names that he listed in chapter 10, was to prove at the time he sat down to write it that all the people groups of the earth can be found somewhere in those original eight people that were on the boat. Got all that? And it is an explanation, if you understand that curse between those people groups, it'll help you understand why it is that God took Abraham, a Shemite, and brought him into Canaan and promised him that land. Right? Okay. And that's good. We will start at chapter 11, and that takes us to the Tower of Babel, and we'll deal with that next week.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.